Welcome to the online ministry of Pacific Beach United Methodist Church, located in beautiful San Diego, California. Pacific Beach UMC is a member of the Reconciling Ministries Network and welcomes persons of all ages and backgrounds for worship, study, and service opportunities. More information can be found on our website at pbumc.org. May you be enriched in the hearing of these words, and may you receive and enjoy God's blessing.
When I was 11 years old, I got mad at my mom. The reason I got mad at my mom is because she did that annoying parent thing that sometimes parents do. She proved me wrong. And as an 11-year-old, you're never wrong. That's my sense of it. Probably any of those, 11, 12, 13, 14. The way that she proved me wrong went like this. See, I had PE homework. I was in seventh grade, and I had homework for my PE class. And it wasn't written homework. It's just that part of what I had to do was I had to get some kind of aerobic exercise, and then I had to write that down. I had to document that. And then my parents had to sign, and I had to turn it in. And part of my grade was based on how much aerobic homework I did. And they taught me, they said, basketball counts, right? Walking and running counts. Football doesn't count. They take too many breaks in football, right? I walked to school every day. I walked to school and I walked home, and I figured that should be enough. And if we get in the car and we drive from the house to the school, it takes about 5 minutes to get there, okay? So obviously it's 5 miles there and back. I'm walking 10 miles a day. In my 11-year-old brain, that's how that worked. So my mom is signing my PE homework, and she says, "You do not walk 10 miles a day." What, I walk to and from school? It's 5 miles each. No, it's not. And then she put me in the car, and she marked down the reading on the odometer, and she drove there and said, "Look, it's only 2.5 miles. I was so mad. My very livelihood depends on my PE grade. Turns out I still walked enough to get a decent, to get the credit I needed. Now, and one of the things that happened when I walked to and from school, you see, I was in the band too. I was one of those kids. I was the band kid. And I played the saxophone in the band, but I didn't just carry, the alto sax. You see, I'd moved up to a bigger horn. I was playing the baritone sax. And sometimes, this horn, sometimes I would carry this baritone sax back and forth to school. And that's a big horn. The reason I tell you this story is because I'm going to tell you another story that's related to that. See, this story about walking back and forth to school, 2.5 miles each way. By the way, we lived on a hill that was on top of a hill, so it was really true to say that I walked uphill both ways. I was telling this story to a group of kids, and we were taking a group of kids on this mission trip when I served at a church in Nebraska. And we were driving. We rented this big van, and we were driving from Grand Island, Nebraska to Denver, where everything was going to take place for this mission trip. And we got into some conversation with some of the kids in the van about walking to and from school. Now, an important part of this story is that there were people in our congregation who had immigrated from South Sudan. Now, I say South Sudan, and if you look at the Nuba Mountains, which is where these folks were from, if you look at the Nuba Mountains, it looks like it's in the south part of Sudan. You see, Sudan is a separate country from South Sudan. And if you look, hold on, you're giving away, hold on, all right, shh, you didn't see that. Okay, if you look, South Sudan is separate from Sudan, and it's a contested region, and the place where the Nuba Mountains are, okay, is actually contested. It shows on Google Maps that it's in Sudan, but if you live in the Nuba Mountains, you would claim that you're in South Sudan. That's how I understand it from the people that I met from that region. Let me tell you what it's like to live in the Nuba Mountains. You see, you may live in and amongst lots of caves, but let me tell you what wealth looks like if you live in the Nuba Mountains. Unimaginable, unattainable, mind-blowing wealth is someone who owns a cow. A cow. You can't imagine ever being that successful to own a cow. There are so few people who do. And that's what wealth looks like. And yet in this same Nuba Mountain region of Sudan, South Sudan, where being wealthy means owning a cow, this region is bombarded from the air because it's still contested and still, you could say, it's experiencing civil war. So this is the region that these people that I got to know immigrated from. They were brought in to work at the local meatpacking plant. By the way, I talked to someone, this is a little aside, I talked to someone who had immigrated from Sudan who told me that story about what it means to be rich if someone owns a cow, and then he was brought to the U.S. to work at a meatpacking plant where he just saw cows going by him all day long. Talk about mind-blowing. Anyway, so we're with this youth group, and a bunch of these kids are from Sudan, and they're talking about walking back and forth. And, you know, here I am sort of getting on my high horse. In hindsight, it was an incredibly privileged position I was coming from. They're talking about walking back and forth to school, and sometimes that's rough, and they don't want to do that, and it takes some time. I said, oh, you know, I had to walk 2.5 miles each way, uphill both ways, and sometimes I carried a saxophone. And one of these kids looked at me, and he had that look on his face that teenagers sometimes get when they know they're about to get you. He said, my family walked to Egypt. They walked from the Nuba Mountains to Egypt to escape the violence and the terror of where they'd grown up, where they'd been born. 1,250 miles, roughly. That's Nuba Mountains to Cairo. I don't know if they went to Cairo or another city. I know that they escaped, that the way they got to the U.S. was through Egypt. And I found myself this week thinking about what it would be like to take that journey. What it would be like to walk 1,250 miles, right? From a country where wealth looks like somebody has a cow, and you're not wealthy, so you're just going to take whatever you can take and start heading north because you're in fear for your life and the life of your family. I imagine the ache of feet and joints and hips and your body. I imagine hunger. And I say I imagine hunger because it's not like, oh, you know, I skipped breakfast today and I'm feeling hungry. It's not like that. It's like I had a little bit of bread yesterday and water isn't quite quenching my hunger anymore, and there's not much of that anyway, and I don't know if I'm going to eat today. It's hunger on a level, frankly, I don't think I've ever experienced. I imagine it to be this whole body hunger. And I imagine these families walking from everything they knew, from the landscape to the weather to the people to the cultures to the customs to the meals that they're used to something completely different, and doing it on foot. Now, the reason I've been thinking about that story today is because it seems like that could be what these people who were following Jesus might have been experiencing. I mentioned that there are these two different feeding stories in Mark 6 and in Mark 8, but what it tells us in Mark 8 is that Jesus says, I feel sorry for the crowd because they've been with me for 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them away hungry to their homes, they won't have enough strength to travel because some have come a long distance. I don't know if people went 1,200 miles to follow Jesus, but they went a distance. So much so that Jesus was concerned to just send them away because they might not be able to make the journey. Now, with these two different feeding stories, the story between the Gospel of the sixth chapter of the Gospel of Mark and the eighth chapter of the Gospel of Mark, it's really interesting that this that there's two sort of similar stories. Now, it's important to note that this story in the Gospel of Mark in the sixth chapter, the feeding of 5,000, is paralleled in all four of the Gospels. It's in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Okay? But a secondary story where 4,000 people are fed, that's only in Mark and Matthew. It's not in Luke and John. Now, the Gospel of Mark, most scholars agree, was written earlier. Matthew likely used Mark as a source. That's probably where the author of the Gospel of Matthew got it. But what does it mean that this story happens twice? What are some of the similarities? What are some of the differences? And what can we learn that can impact our lives today? Let's look at it. So in the sixth chapter of Mark, there were 5,000 people who were fed. And in the eighth chapter, there were 4,000. There are these striking parallels through all of these. They're not necessarily in the same order, but they all happen. Okay? So in Mark 6, 5,000 with 5 loaves and 2 fish. In Mark 8, there were 4,000 with 7 loaves and a few fish. It doesn't tell us how many. It just says a few. On Planet Bob, a few is exactly 3. I don't know if it's the same thing for you, but that's just how it shows up in my brain. Okay. There was an interaction with Pharisees. Okay, in Mark chapter 7, we read that actually last week, where the Pharisees criticize Jesus and the disciples. Why are you eating with those people who don't wash their hands before a meal in this ritually specific way? Jesus says, listen, you're not going to contaminate yourself that way, right? It's what comes out of the mouth that contaminates, right? It's what's broken and infectious inside that then comes out in our words and actions, right? That's what's corrupting. Okay, so, and then in Mark 8, later on, there's a conversation with Pharisees. So there's some parallel there. There's in Mark 6, after that story, it's a little bit later, there's a healing of a deaf man. A little bit later than the Mark 8 feeding story, there's a healing of a blind man. It's interesting that these are both stories about healings and restoring perception. And then lastly, after Mark 6, there's a scene in a boat and walking on water. That in part of that, there's some private instruction. After the story of feeding in Mark 8, there's some private instruction with the disciples. Do you see how there's some real similarities in these stories? And yet there are striking differences as well. The reason that people in the Mark 6 story are hungry is that there's just been too much going on. People have been active. And they haven't had time to eat. And one of the things that one of my reading sources highlighted for me is it's likely that if there was so much going on, then they probably weren't in an area that was barren or deserted, wilderness. They were probably in an area that was more populated. There were more resources available. It's just the people were too busy. There was so much going on. There was so much learning from Jesus. There was so much interacting with the disciples. There wasn't time to eat. And some scholars would say, well, perhaps that was a more Jewish community, a more religious majority community. But in Mark 8, we read that they're so far away that Jesus is concerned if they don't eat, that they're not going to make the journey. So we might imagine this as a more rural area, a more wilderness area, an area that's farther away. And sometimes those who live farther away do so because they are marginalized. And some scholars would argue that perhaps this is a more Gentile community. And what importance might there be if one story happens for a Jewish community and the other happens for a Gentile community? Well, later on in the eighth chapter of the Gospel of Mark, the disciples realize they've messed something up. You see, after feeding 4,000 people in the eighth chapter with 7 loaves and a few fish, they collect the leftovers. There's 7 baskets, but what the disciples end up with for themselves is just 1 loaf. You see, it seems as though the rest of the bread went to those who were journeying back to their homes. And they get sort of worked up about this, and Jesus begins to talk to them about it. It starts in chapter 8, verse 14. Jesus' disciples had forgotten to bring any bread, so they only had 1 loaf with them in the boat. They were in a boat, of course. And he gave them strict orders. He said, watch out and be on your guard for the yeast of the Pharisees as well as the yeast of Herod. I didn't understand what that meant. I had to look it up. I was confused what it might mean for them to talk about the yeast of the Pharisees and the yeast of Herod. And what I found helpful is an understanding of what was understood about what yeast or leaven is, right? That substance that you put in the dough that makes it rise. See, in ancient times, it was thought that that was a process of, a minor process, but still a process of decay. That there was some decaying that took place that caused the gases to expand and the bread to rise. I wonder, is this why for particularly holy celebrations in the Jewish tradition, it's important to use unleavened bread? Because it's not participated in that symbol of decay. And so when I hear about Jesus talking about the leaven of the Pharisees, the yeast of the Pharisees, the yeast of Herod, I wonder if this connects back to that story where Jesus said it's not what goes into a person that contaminates, but what's already there, the brokenness, the selfishness, the narcissism, that when it comes out in those angry and fearful words, when it comes out in that hurtful language, that that's what defiles. As Jesus talked to the disciples after this, he interrogated them. It was interesting the way he did it because in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus is very critical of the disciples. He says, "Don't you grasp what's happened? Don't you understand? Are your hearts so resistant to what God's doing? Don't you have eyes? Why can't you see? Don't you have ears? Why can't you hear? Don't you remember?" And then he goes through the differences. "When I broke 5 loaves of bread for 5,000 people, how many baskets full of leftovers did you gather?" And they answered, 12. "When I broke 7 loaves of bread for these 4,000 people, how many baskets of leftovers did you gather?" And they answered, 7. Jesus said to them, "And still you don't understand." I've been thinking about this. I've been wrestling with this because this is hard. And here's one of the things that I come up with. One, Jesus is asking hard questions to the disciples. But it seems as though the way he's asking the questions, there's still a little bit of hope. It seems as though he says, "You still don't understand?" As though maybe they're on the precipice, maybe they're on the edge. And I think maybe they are on the edge. Because it's just a few verses later when Jesus asked the disciples a question, "Who do people say that I am? John the Baptist, Elijah. Who do you say that I am?" And it's Peter who says, "You are the Christ." I feel like they're just on the edge. And I wonder if we ever feel spiritually like we're just on the edge. We're just about to get it. But still, we're spiritually hungry. Still, we need a bit more. And then I look back at those two stories. I look at Jesus gathered with what may have been a largely Jewish community. I look at when Jesus was feeding what may have been a largely Gentile community, and it hits me. Jesus' sustenance, Jesus' sense, Jesus' teaching, Jesus' presence, Jesus' gifts are here for us all. Jews and Gentile alike. And not only is Jesus' sustenance and spirit and miracles and teachings enough, it's more than enough. Enough so that there's leftovers. Enough so that maybe there's even crumbs for those who have been cast aside. Yes, the Gentiles. Do you remember that story about the woman who wanted to experience Jesus' healing and he questions her in a difficult way? She touches his robe. And he feels the power. And he says, "Who touched me?" She says, "I needed to experience your healing." He says, "Why you? You're not Jewish." He says, "Maybe the food is for the chosen people." And she says, "Yes, even the dogs get the crumbs." And maybe this second story with a community of hungry people who may have been more Gentile than Jewish, maybe it's a sign that the crumbs are more substantial than we think. Maybe it's a sign that Jesus is enough. You know, when we feel bogged down by the world, when we feel like the world is caving in, when we feel like everything is happening to us, and sometimes it's broken relationships, and sometimes it's a lousy job, and sometimes it's a difficult family relationship, and sometimes it's horrible things that happen just outside of our control, and sometimes it's grief and loss. When we feel like the world is happening to us, and we feel like we can't take it anymore, we can't take the weight of it, sometimes it's good to remember that Jesus is enough. And we may find that experience in some miraculous way, and we might find it through the love and care and support and exactly the right words at the right time from that one person. And we may remember that Jesus is enough.